I listen to advice from folks smarter than me. And I ignored it. I listen to music from folks darker than me. And you know,
that's the song Steal Your Rock and Roll from the 2010 Tony Award-winning Memphis and the National Touring Company of Memphis, now performing at the Ohio Theater through Sunday. For more information on that, you can go to WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have a link there for you to Kappa. The song references the African-American origins of what was called race music in the segregated South and the love of the music by the lead character in the story, Huey Calhoun, an uneducated but charismatic devotee of the Beale Street rhythm and blues scene of the 1950s, a character based on the real life of Dewey Phillips, who brought rock and roll to the Memphis airwaves with the likes of Muddy Waters, B.B. King, and others. Coming up later, we'll hear from more music from that era and hear from scholars who have studied it. Joining us now is Brian Fenkart. He plays the lead character, Huey Calhoun, in the National Touring Company of Memphis. He was part of the original ensemble cast of Memphis and served as understudy for the same role in the Broadway production. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Also, Julie Johnson, she plays Gladys Calhoun, the mother of the Huey Calhoun character in the National Touring Company of Memphis. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Questions or comments from our listeners, 614-292-8513 if you want, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Dewey Phillips' two sons saw the show in Memphis, Brian, and gave your portrayal of their father their stamp of approval. How is it to portray a fictionalized character of someone like that?
I mean, it was after listening to clips of his show. You know, I used to listen to little clips of it when I was still learning the part of Red Hot and Blue, the show that he used to do, and in a way, I was almost grateful that he was harder to understand than I was, you know, because the way that I had to do it is it's such a rapid fire delivery, and you know, he's making up words and things like that. So I was worried about that. Then I heard him, and I said, "Oh, okay." I feel a little bit better because you're lucky if you can understand a quarter of what that guy says on the air, you know. He was just a free spirit, I guess, you know. But actually, basing the character off him was a really neat thing to do because he was groundbreaking at the time. You know, he was somebody who was doing something totally different, and that rebellious streak is a fun thing to play. Let alone all the physical and vocal quirks that he had. It was also neat to play somebody who was really groundbreaking at the time, and you know, having his family see it was vindicating in a weird way. You know, I remember when they came backstage to meet me after the show, and one of them, his son, had said to me, "Thanks for bringing my dad back to life," which, of course, I got choked up, and I was trying to stay a man and say, "Oh, yeah, of course, you're welcome,
it's
sir.
Just a job, yeah."
Yeah, and it's all part of the job.
It's what I do.
And in the meantime, just, you know, weeping on the inside. but it was pretty special.
How much did you know, Julie, about the era when you auditioned or when you took on the role?
Well, I'm originally from a small town in Texas, so my high school, elementary high school years were the late 60s and all through the 70s, and so I was familiar with the whole relationship between black and white and the strain. Like I have said before, I had friends and relatives, family friends and relatives that I loved very dearly, and I could hardly reconcile the side of them that saw that there was this line between black and white. And I celebrate differences in us. I think we should all really maintain our wonderful differences and the texture that makes us who we are. But as far as equality of personhood, you know, for black and white, I couldn't reconcile that in my mind. And seeing this show, knowing the character now, reading the character, when I read the sides for the audition, I thought, gosh, I fortunately and unfortunately know exactly who Mama is. I know who this woman is that was raised to feel that whites were better than African Americans, and that, you know, you didn't mix and you didn't shake up the status quo. Don't step out and do anything different. A lot of fear-based, you know, fear-based anger and a fear-based prejudice, you know, in a woman like that. And so I knew how to play it. And then I also, luckily for the character and for the show, she does have her redemption. And that's the part where I really love to sail right into that time in the show where she says, wait a minute, I've been to a black church, I've heard the sermon, and I have been changed.
And my guests are cast members Brian Fenkart and Julie Johnson from Memphis the Musical. It's at the Ohio Theater right now. You can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides and get a link to that if you want to know more about it. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513. Yeah, Julie, your character, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the one character in the whole show that really does have a complete change of heart. Now, some of the, you know, radio station owners and those guys do, but that's for purely mercenary purposes.
Exactly.
That they change things.
Yes.
Because they can make a bunch of money.
The dollar signs start to look so good that they decide to at least entertain this idea of playing the music on their airwaves. Brian was talking about the patter and everything that Dewey Phillips did and the way he spoke. And I think this shows in the show, too. Part of that appeal, I think, to the teenagers at the time was it was almost like they had their own language. Mom and Dad didn't understand him, but they did. And that kind of that truly helped begin a change in our culture. Young, white Americans and Southerners listening to the African-American music and saying, whoa, wait, this is amazing. Why are my parents trying to keep me away from this? And then the rebellion began.
The rebellious white kids in the show are—it's hysterical, kind of. I mean, just that it's like they're just being unlocked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely unlocked. Someone flips a switch.
Exactly.
And they're going crazy.
And the lights come on.
Right. We have another song. It's from the show Memphis. It's called "Music of My Soul." Let's listen to it. It is sung by the main character DJ Huey Calhoun about growing up in Memphis, how his father taught him white should stay with white and don't you never go to the dark side of town. But he heard the music through the alleys and he snuck down anyway.
But I heard it through the alley.
That song, that's not you, Brian, singing that. That's from the Broadway show.
Yeah, that's right. That's the Broadway.
But I loved hearing you sing it, and I wondered how it felt to sing something like that and how you pull that in and then break it out.
I love the song, and it was actually the first song written for the show. When Joe DiPietro, the writer of the show, approached David Bryan about writing it, that was the first song he wrote. He wrote it overnight and, you know, delivered it to his doorstep basically the next morning, I think. And so it really sort of was what unlocked the whole show. You know, it sort of was the meaning of everything you were going to see is in that song. It's a nice. It's not the opener of the show. I think it's the second song in the show, but it's still. You know, it's a nice preface of everything that, you know, Huey's about to go through. And I love singing that also because as I'm a musician myself and as somebody who really believes in the power of music and things like that, you know, that helps me to connect to that song and to really, you know, let my own personality shine out through that song. And, you know, to talk about my own passion for the music, it matches his, you know. So, it's a great song to open the show with, despite the fact that it's high.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, no one in this show really gets off easily in the vocal department. We are all, especially not Brian and Felicia Boswell, who plays Felicia Farrell, and is just phenomenal. Every voice in the show is, I think, gives every ounce of vocal strength and stamina that they have all night.
Yeah, there's not one moment of letdown. Not one moment.
No.
It's just, it's all the way up there. The Music in My Soul is, it is a very poignant song, and contrasting it with how goofy Huey or, you know, can come across a lot of the time, kind of gangling and also they refer to him as stupid a lot.
Yeah.
And he's really a visionary. The real life character and the guy in the show is a visionary. He's kind of a prodigy. He's very young at the time.
Yeah. I mean, it also, you know, it depends on people's definition of stupid. You know, I mean, because was he book smart? Not at all. Not at all. He was not a book smart person, but he was incredibly impulsive, for one. And he was also somebody who didn't necessarily think that the rules were in place to be followed. He thought that they were in place, you know, to possibly be broken. And it wasn't even necessarily his intention to rebel against anything. All his intention was just to do what he felt was right and do what he felt to have people hear what he thought should be heard. So, I mean, to say that he was a visionary, I mean, he wasn't trying to change the world. It was an accident, really. What he was trying to do was just to let people feel what he was feeling, let people, you know, hear what he was hearing. And some people can consider impulsiveness stupidity because he's not thinking of what he's doing in advance. He's not thinking of consequences. Consequences don't exist for Huey. And if that's stupid, yeah, maybe it is. But it's also how a lot of the greatest minds and, greatest doers in the world have ever done anything was without thinking of consequences.
Your relationship, mother and son relationship, is the most humorous part. It's a lot of fun, and I was just wondering how you work together and how that works.
I kind of feel like, and you can correct your mother if she's wrong once, but I feel like it happened the very first day, the first read through, and certainly in the first few days of rehearsal, because he had been on Broadway with two different mamas, two different actresses. And so here comes mama number three. What's she going to be? And like I said, I grew up with a lot of women like mama, and I knew exactly who she was and why she phrased the things the way she phrased them, and had heard it, things like that, repeatedly as a child. So, it was innate in me. Not the prejudice, but the Southern delivery, if you will, and the realm of the Southern mother was to chew your son out and just tell him everything you need to, and then afterwards saying, I love you, baby. And then, you know, so all is well, I've said my piece, and now we're all good. Okay, let's have some supper. You know, that's kind of the Southern way for a lot of mothers, especially back then. And because no matter how much they made you mad, and this any mother, I have a 13-year-old son, it's the same way. No matter how much they made you mad, how much they break the rules or whatever, you still love them.
See, and I haven't killed them yet.
That's right, you're still living, so it means I love you. So I felt like the relationship really grew during the rehearsal period, and you know, we helped shape each other's characters by what each of us brought to the scene work.
After you did understudy and before, how did you make it your own after watching somebody else do it?
Well, a lot of what the original guy did, Chad Kimball, was the original Huey on Broadway. And I got to watch him, you know, and listen to him for a long time. And I thought a lot of what he brought to the role was brilliant. And I thought that he really shaped this character really, really beautifully. but, you know, with any actor, you're just physically you're different. Vocally, you're different. So if I adopted exactly what he did, it wouldn't have worked. So that makes it easier in a sense to make it my own, is because if I tried to just do an imitation, if I tried to just sort of mimic what he did, it wouldn't have worked at all. So, you know, so did I keep a lot of the vocal choices he made? Yes, but made them match my voice. I liked a lot of the physicality, but I had to bring it into my own body. I mean, I'm a lot taller than he is, for one. And that's something that I had to adjust. And, but making it my own, it's just sort of, as an actor, any role that you do, you're going to want to base it off something that you've seen, you know, whether it's a character walk or a voice or something that you know, or especially if it's based on a historical figure, you're going to want to match them in some way. But if you try to imitated, it'll become inorganic and not believable, because what you're doing is something so outside of you that it'll be evident to an audience that you're not comfortable with it. So you want to do something that's comfortable in your own body and your own voice, but so it's organic and believable to an audience. So I just would basically mold a lot of his choices and tack on a few of my own to make it more personal to me and still have it be believable, even though he's such a out there sort of guy.
Well, I saw Brian do it on Broadway the night before we started rehearsals. And I, as an observer and also a participant, to me, you have really morphed the character more toward your take on it now that we've been through the rehearsals and been out on the road together. It's a lot more of you brought into the character than it had been. And that was one of the wonderful things about our director, Christopher Ashley, in the rehearsal period. He encouraged us to make every one of these characters our own.
Someone asked Elmore Watcher last night, we have to take a break real quick here. But they said, is that his real voice? Someone behind me is like,
yeah, luckily not.
I don't think so, but I'll let you
luckily
know.
It is
listen
not.
To the show tomorrow. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Michael Lind joins us on the great tug of war in American economic history over when government should lead. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. It's 77 degrees in downtown Columbus with sunshine and a high near 80 degrees. Clear skies for tonight and a low of 53 degrees. Mostly sunny for Thursday and a cooler day, a high of 71. And there's a chance of showers moving into the area Thursday night, a low of 58 degrees. Join All Sides with Ann Fisher Friday from 10 until noon for a special live broadcast on location from the WOSU booth at the Columbus Arts Festival. Listen on 89.7 NPR News or visit Ann downtown near the corner of Rich Street and Civic Center Drive. During this special show, Ann will be talking about the festival's move back to the riverfront, downtown redevelopment, arts and culture in Columbus, and more. Listen on 89.7 NPR News or join All Sides at the Columbus Arts Festival this Friday from 10 until noon. And All Sides continues in just a moment. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
We're talking about the National Touring Company of Memphis production at the Ohio Theater this week, and also the rock and roll sound that changed America with two stars from the National Touring Company of Memphis. Brian Fenkart, who plays the lead character Huey Calhoun in Memphis, a character based on the life and times of Dewey Phillips. And also Julie Johnson, who plays Gladys Calhoun. She's the mother of Huey Calhoun character in the National Touring Company of Memphis. Joining us now is Lewis Cantor. He's a professor emeritus of history at Indiana University. He's written Wheelin' on Beale, How WDIA Memphis Became the Nation's First All-Black Radio Station and Created the Sound That Changed America. And his most recent book, Dewey and Elvis, The Life and Times of a Rock and Roll DJ. Lewis Cantor grew up in Memphis and went to high school with Elvis Presley, apparently. Welcome to the show, Lewis.
Thank you. I tell all my students that I went to school with Elvis Presley, and I'm a historian, and I teach history, and they don't want to know much about history after that. They all only wanted to know about more about Elvis.
Absolutely, and of course. And what's your point, Lewis? Let's listen. Lewis Jordan was one of the first black recording artists to cross over to the mainstream audience with several top 10 hits on the white pop charts. Let's listen to his 1946 recording of Buzz Me Baby.
Buzz me, baby. I'll be waiting for your call. Buzz me, baby. I'll be waiting for your call. If you forgot the number, come on over, you won't have to call at all.
Louis Jordan was a musician, singer, songwriter, and band leader who was popular from the late 1930s to the 1950s. That music was maybe a precursor to what finally broke through onto the mainstream radio stations. Louis Jordan? I'm sorry, Louis Cantor?
Yeah, I think it was. The couple of things that happened in Memphis that were really important, and Dewey was a big part of that story. Jim Dickinson, who was a kind of a music historian himself and a entertainer and a film producer and whatnot, said that 1949 was the it year. He said it was it because two things happened. One was the WDIA became the first all-black radio station in the country, and the second was Dewey Phillips' radio show started. And those two things occurring were primarily responsible, I think, for the shift. For the shift from the Dewey was able to play for the white audience. They put him on the air because WDIA was doing so well, the all-black program station. Memphis was already 1950, I think it was. Memphis was already about 40% black, and no one was programming for that black audience. Anyway, they were a smash when they put Nat Williams on, the first black announcer to come on. And from that point on, it was WDIA was just huge in the ratings, and WHBQ, which was Dewey's station, decided they better get in there and try to join in the fight and put Dewey on the air. And the phenomenal thing that happened was that they put him on the air primarily to capture that black audience when WDIA went off. And instead of capturing the black audience, he, of course, captured the heart and soul, I guess, of every white teenager in Memphis by listening to him. He legitimized it. He opened it up for the white teenagers. Most parents would not allow their daughters and their sons to listen to black music. But they would listen to a white man programming black music. And, of course, he was so incredibly popular that he, I think, changed most of the South himself.
Dewey Phillips, he was a force of nature. He was a visionary in a way. What about his personal regard? I mean, how did he regard himself personally at that stage?
Well, he, I think, never really perceived that he was going to do much to do change anything except have a good show, and it was quite entertaining and extraordinarily entertaining. And I think he never saw himself in terms of the big picture, that what was happening with the big picture, that a massive change was indeed taking place. I think Mark Fisher's got it right in that regard. There was a tremendous influence of an entire generation. And I don't think he ever perceived that. He got very, very bad in his last years. He got hooked on drugs and alcohol, and he was almost a homeless man at the end, and real sad case. So I just don't think that he perceived himself as being someone who made a contribution to the general history of this country.
So you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest I'm talking with right now, Louis Cantor. He's a author and professor emeritus of history at Indiana University. He wrote the book Dewey and Elvis, The Life and Times of a Rock and Roll DJ. He also referred to Mark Fisher, author and senior editor for The Washington Post. He'll be joining us as well in a few minutes. Still with us, cast members Brian Fenkart and Julie Johnson, stars from Memphis, the musical. Louis?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What was the question?
Well, one of the things, Dewey Phillips was uneducated and poor, and in the show Memphis, he's often referred to as stupid. We talked about this earlier. What do we really know about his intellect, ultimately?
I don't know. I almost have to recluse myself. Is that the right word?
Recluse, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In that regard, I think that the young people who perform in the show did a marvelous job with it, and I think that's why they've had, I think I've heard at least that they've had SRO, had standing room only, practically since the thing opened. So they've done a marvelous job with that. They're entertainers, and that's one genre. And I think the other genre is what his place in the history of our times is. And I think he's completely overlooked in terms of the history of rock and roll. he's on the air. Alan Freed usually gets all the credit. Mm-hmm. Alan Freed is the man that everybody says revolutionized thing. Well, Dewey was playing rock and roll and playing wild people in terms of the way the South perceived it 2 full years before Alan Freed ever started playing. Alan Freed in 1951 was still, 1940, 50, 51, was still playing classical music in Cleveland. Dewey was way ahead of his time. He was already there doing it and making it hot long before he arrived. And I think that in that regard, you have to see it that way. I don't think that the stage, the Broadway production was an excellent production, but I think you have to make that distinction between the two. So I wouldn't dare criticize anything in that regard, but it won't tell you, the Broadway play doesn't tell you a great deal about the importance of Dewey.
The music is somewhat different, too, and I was wondering, Brian Fenkart, about that and how you felt, and also Julie Johnson, that it's all original music. It's not that great stuff like from Louis Jordan, but
yeah, I mean, I personally, I think that that's one of the selling points of the show, and I say that because I think that the Broadway market is oversaturated right now with jukebox musicals, which are, I know, it's the songs of fill in the blank, you know, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, mm-hmm. Green Day, whatever, and to have a show that is wholly original, but is based on the styles of the time, of the, you know, R&B, blues, gospel that was going on at the time, but it's still original music, I think it's refreshing for a lot of audiences to come in and see something that they haven't seen before but will still remember, hopefully, you know, when they walk out of the theater.
Well, also one of the things that David Bryan did, I think, so beautifully was marry the two worlds of music that sounds like it could have been on the radio at the time. There's one song in there that Felicia sings that you just know Diana Ross would have recorded. Music that sounds like something that would have been played at the time, but yet it's still plot-driven and plot-propelling, like the music of traditional musicals and musical comedies. So to bring those two worlds together was really quite a feat, and especially for a man writing his first musical. So I stand backstage every night and think, what a brilliant job of writing this is to be able to bring those two worlds together.
Louis Cantor, what'd you think?
Yeah, I think so. Sure enough, it was, and it is a wonderful job. The only thing I had that bothered me throughout was the a bit of, and I'm not totally sure that Brian was there that night. He might have been you know, the stand-in, but was the accent, you know, had they attempted the Southern accent for so many years, having lived in the South, it always disturbed me a little to hear. To hear that accent, you know, you should be talking kind of like this, and don't worry about how it sounds, and don't, you know, dot your I's and cross your T's and so on. And I don't know, but it's silly to even talk about it because it's such a minor point. But overall, I think that I'm asking, you know, as a historian, that these things that I'd like to see have seen and didn't.
Well, I'm a native Southerner. You wouldn't have seen me on Broadway. I'm the tour mama, and I agree with you. I agree with you wholeheartedly. We have several native Southerners in the cast, you know, a little spread out from Georgia to Alabama to Texas. I'm a Texan, but my family roots are Tennessee Volunteers. So we have some similarities in our accent, and I do believe that in our production that has really, that throwing all those ingredients into the pot has made a delicious stew, and we've actually managed to really portray the Southern mystique, if you will, and the Southern accent very, very correctly.
Brian, a lot of extra pressure when it comes to things like that?
There can be, especially because, you know, like what Louis was just saying about the accent, he's absolutely right. It's just the trick is being able to talk with a genuine Southern accent and have 3,000 people understand you.
Yeah, really.
Every night.
And then
inject his personality on top of
and
that.
And then inject the personality.
Which was so distinctive.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, there is some added pressure. You know, and I remember one time there was one reviewer who saw it in Memphis who said that my accent sounded more like it was from Knoxville than Memphis. And I said, you know what? I was just shooting for the area.
I'll take it.
Yes, it's in the same state.
I was throwing a wide net over Tennessee, yeah. So I was pretty happy.
I kind of targeted Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, is where I targeted for Mama. So she
was more part of this excuse me, if you're in the western part of the state, you're usually, seen as in the days when I was there, at least, they were Democratic. In the east, where Knoxville is located, well, that's where all the Republicans live. So maybe it was that dichotomy.
That might have been it.
Now, Louis Cantor, Dewey was something of a singer himself.
Yes, he was. He actually recorded a song. And you guys, I'm sure, generation-wise, don't know anything about the man that sang, I'm walking in the rain. I can't think of it myself now at this particular moment. But he actually recorded a song. But he had his favorites. He was just like Elvis to a large extent in that they played all, they loved all kind of music. Sam Phillips told me at one time when I interviewed him for hours and hours, he's the man who discovered Elvis. And he said that Elvis said, he asked him just off the top of his head, what's the favorite type of music that Elvis likes? And he started out talking about Dean Martin said he felt that that's who he liked as the traditional singer. So you get that, and Dewey had that. He had that same kind of conglomeration of various types of music that he played on the show, but always it was, of course, the introduction of the new sound of rock and roll.
There are so many aspects of Dewey that could have been brought out. There's so many stories in his life. Brian, Julie, I suppose too, not the Elvis part of it brought in.
I mean, I'm actually kind of glad that it isn't included because we came out at the same exact time as Million Dollar Quartet, which I think would have done us some damage. I think if we'd focused too much on that, plus I think it would have taken away from the importance of the civil rights aspect of the story to focus too much on the Elvis aspect of the story.
But there are a couple of little homages in the script. I'm called Mama all through the show, but she's named Gladys, which of course. We know who Gladys was. That was Elvis's mama, the ultimate mama. And then also there's a reference when the owner of the radio station says, well, people have to know that you're white. Tell them what high school you went to. And tells him to go on the air and tell him what high school they went to. That's what they used to do with Elvis.
And he finished the ninth grade.
But they would announce that Elvis graduated from, and you, sir, would know what high school. I don't know what it is, but I will remember it if you tell me.
Yeah. It's Humes High School.
Humes High School, and that way everyone knew, okay, so he is white.
It was terribly segregated in Memphis at that time. So Humes was where all the white folks went, and black people went to a separate school entirely. So that was the first thing he asked me. But let me just say one thing about that as we're talking about that topic, where Elvis belongs and all of this. You know, Dewey sort of made the sound ready for Elvis to hit the screen, make his impression on the world. He could play the music, and he played it so much that I talked to a great many of the young musicians in Memphis at the time I was writing the book, and they said that the sound was there when Elvis stepped in. So Dewey sort of set him up for it, set those listeners up for the preparation. Elvis comes on the scene, and everybody knows the story about how revolutionary he was. But I think they failed to see Dewey's place again in the history of rock and roll.
He was the first DJ to play Elvis.
He's the first DJ to play Elvis, and he actually plugged Elvis. Elvis wasn't even sure he wanted to go on. After That's All Right, Little Mama, which was the first big huge super hit with the song, the Sun label, and before he signed with RCA, anybody else would have thought, well, I'm on the way to stardom now. But Elvis kept driving his truck even after that happened. He didn't realize that he was going to be able to make his livelihood from singing in front of an audience.
Dewey did have a television show at one point. It was depicted in the show Memphis as well. Did he do as well? He's a good-looking guy. Did he do as well with TV as he did with radio?
Well, no. It was kind of a bomb, actually. He wasn't the bomb, but we were in that transitional stage where everybody was going to TV, and his show was just entirely different from TV. He got wiped out by top 40 plays on the radio, where the whole thing is, you give the time and the temperature, and you play a top 40 song, and da-da-da-da. And, of course, Dewey was this character who just people listened to just to be entertained by Dewey as well as listening to the music. He was quite a character on the air, and he was phenomenally successful. They told me stories. Everybody had a story about Dewey when I was working on the book, that so many people listened to him. He was estimated to have about 100,000 listeners just in that little section of Memphis, and then, of course, you go out to the entire Mid-South, and I don't know how many were listening, but he became so popular that all the ratings are showing that he was just getting it all, just about, that the only real competitive station was the WMPS, which played kind of Western country and Western music. The story was that on a Saturday night when Dewey was had the entire audience, the WMPS just gave up on trying to compete with him, that they just didn't have an announcer. They had the they didn't have an announcer in the booth on Saturday night. They were playing, they were playing with the old-fashioned LPs that used to drop down, and they, you know, and then another record played, and it dropped down again, and they said if you listen carefully on a Saturday night, you could hear this record fall, and then it played 40.
Just had four or five of them stacked up.
So they just gave up, you know, Dewey's got it, and forget about it.
Oh, by the way, the show is something of an homage to radio as well, which was very comforting for me seeing in the audience last night. I want to thank my guests, cast members from the touring production of Memphis. Brian Fenkart plays Huey Calhoun on the show, stars in it. Thanks again, Brian, for joining us today.
Oh, no, thanks for having me, yeah.
And also, Julie Johnson plays Huey's mama.
That's
Julie,
right.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. We enjoyed it very much.
Coming back, we'll continue our conversation about the era of Dewey Phillips. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. And in 20 minutes at noon, Fresh Air begins. Coming up on today's Fresh Air, the pioneering bluegrass country and folk guitar player, singer-songwriter Doc Watson has died at the age of 89. Listen back to an interview and studio performance with Doc Watson on the next Fresh Air at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to discover more about All Sides with Ann Fisher at WOSU.org/allsides. On the show's website, you can listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 until noon. And you can explore the archive, which includes audio and video of every show. That's WOSU.org/allsides. Sunshine today with a high near 80 degrees. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 53. Sunshine for Thursday and a little cooler, a high of just 71. And rain moving in Thursday night. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The national touring company of the Tony Award-winning Memphis is now at the Ohio Theater through Sunday. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We're talking this hour about rock and roll music that inspired the Broadway story and the man behind the music, 1950s DJ Dewey Phillips. Still with us is Louis Cantor. He's a professor emeritus of history at Indiana University. He's also the author of Dewey and Elvis, The Life and Times of a Rock and Roll DJ. Once again, welcome to the show, Louis.
Thank you so much.
Joining us now is Mark Fisher. He's a senior editor of the Washington Post and author of Something in the Air, Radio, Rock, and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Great to be with you.
Let's listen to Good Rockin' Tonight. It's a 1948 recording by African American rhythm and blues singer Winoni Harris. He's considered one of rock and roll's forerunners.
I heard the news. There's good rockin' tonight.
All right. Winoni Harris had 15 top 10 hits between 1946 and 1952, and you can definitely hear the clear influence he had on Elvis, a little bit of boogie woogie in there. The character Felicia in Memphis, the musical, says at one point, rock and roll really is just Negro blues sped up. Is that true? Is that really, is it just that simple, Mark Fisher?
Well, I mean, musically, there's certainly a clear through line there, but from a kind of marketing perspective of, you know, how did music become popular? How did it reach a broader public? I think what's important is not just the quality of the music but who the artists are, and the racial divide was absolutely defining in the 1940s, and it was there was a time of enormous ferment in the business of show business, because you suddenly had the idea that top 40 radio was just being invented, and suddenly there was a connection between getting your record on the radio and commercial success. And that first became apparent in white radio, but very quickly moved over into to the beginnings of black radio, and that happened in part because the law surrounding who controlled music, and a lot of black music, a lot of black records were not. You didn't have to pay the same kind of royalties that you did for the white records on the more established labels, and so there was a financial incentive all of a sudden for radio stations to open themselves up to playing what was then called race music.
Yeah, acceptance of black R&B musicians was rare in the 1950s mainstream. The breakthroughs were those, who were considered non-threatening, like Chuck Berry and Little Richard.
Sure. In fact, very often what happened in those days was the hits came from white artists who were doing cover versions of race records. Woody Herman, the band leader in 1945, got a big hit out of the cover of Louis Jordan's black hit Caledonia. Then it became a legal issue. A court ruled that musical arrangements could not be copyrighted, and all of a sudden the floodgates opened and white labels just started willy-nilly remaking black tunes without any credit, without any payment.
You know, there was a backlash, and Dewey Phillips did suffer from that, didn't he, Louis Cantor?
Yeah, he did a little bit, but I'm just the things that Mark talked about, I think, are so true. He hit the nail right on the head. It's the whole commercialization of how mm-hmm. these things change, switch from one to the other. The biggest problem that WDIA had when they finally decided to go all black, they started in 48 and as an all-white station, and they were doing this. They tried everything, hillbilly and classical, and they just weren't making it. So they said, and almost what could be described as desperation, now let's put on a Negro announcer. Well, they put Nat Williams on the air. He got something like 2,000 or 3,000 letters the next day or two, and they decided to go to all black. Well, this is 48, and by 1949, they're an all black station. One of the biggest problems that they had was that they didn't have any music to play. The radio station that had been a radio station was a white station, and all of those people like Louis Jordan and some of the others were already playing the music, and they simply unable to get their hands on it, and it was quite a while before they, I talked to the person by then who was already the assistant manager, said that was the first thing they had to do, run out and get a bunch of all new records for the station.
And this was a real risk that they were taking at WDIA. The owners received bomb threats and hate mail for putting black voices on the radio. And in fact, they were very careful about soft pedaling this. They never used the words black or Negro to describe their programming. Their shows had names like Tan Town Coffee Club, Sepia Swing Club, Brown America Speaks. So they, and in fact, in the FCC license renewal application they filed in 1949, they assured the government that we are, quote, proceeding slowly and carefully along this uncharted course. So they were very cautious.
Yep, sure enough. I worked there. I worked as the white the staff announcers that they used in the beginning to make the transition. They just kept, and it took a while before they switched completely to have African American announcers read the news and do that kind of thing. But you're absolutely right about the shows. It was really quite conservative as to what could be happening. And when I heard of the station at the time that it went on, was that the reaction was not nearly as bad as some anticipated. I mean, you know, the Klan was pretty active then. They could have burned the station down. They got hate calls, no question about that. I talked to the person who was on the front desk who would answer the phone initially, and they said that the solution to their, they said, you know, they got people calling up to get that, you know, the N-word off the air. But what happened was, I think the marvel of the thing was that not more was done than could have been done. They said the success of it all was finally telling people who called in and complained. They said, look, Memphis has got 7 radio stations. They're all white. This is one station that black people should have for their very own. And that did it for them. It said it, they said the opposition just died down real fast after that.
Until it started to go mainstream? I mean, when someone like Dewey Phillips brought it onto his radio station or that radio station?
Did he do what? I'm sorry.
I mean, when they did start to introduce it to the white stations, started using it, there was some backlash, though, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. And that was the beauty of Dewey being able to do that. I mean, he had that huge following because of his entertainment skills as much as for the music. And if you were a teenager living in Memphis in the early 50s, well, you just knew that you would be listening to Dewey Phillips. And so that kind of combination, I think, is the thing that really brought it about. I still think that Dewey is the untold story of rock and roll. Not a great many people know about him. All they know is that Dewey played Elvis's first record, and it's usually dropped a little bit, you know, interviewed him and so on, and being in the movie theater, that certain same kind of mantra, and all of that is accurate to an extent, but very, very little about the real story of what happened, and I think I've already hit on.
At WDIA back in the day, the nation's first all-black radio station in Memphis, it did not rouse Memphis blacks politically, though. They didn't go there, did they, Mark Fisher?
No, not really. It really was more of a kind of an opening of a floodgate in entertainment, and the politics on black radio came a little bit later as stations developed a real following, an almost religious following, and stations became the voice of almost supplanting the role of the black press in being the voice of black communities across the country. So later, it was really only once Martin Luther King and Malcolm X came along that a political consciousness began to develop at those stations, that they began to dare to branch out from pure entertainment into sort of a community organizer, community connection kind of role. But the other important thing to realize is that people like Dewey Phillips and both white and black DJs across the country were blindsided by this sudden popularity of this music. This is music that existed in black night spots and backwater clubs for years, for decades, really, prior to the late 1940s. But in the late 40s, when a few DJs like Hunter Hancock in Los Angeles or Hal Jackson in New York started playing this music for a white audience or for a mixed audience, that's what was really revolutionary. And so you had among white kids this almost overnight sensation where this music just burst out of the radio and revolutionized kids' lives. And the political reaction in those days, you had this enormous backlash against what was called racial slurs were used to describe the music, and there was this anti-rock reaction from people like Mitch Miller on TV, who would just unleash this blistering attack on Top 40 radio because it included all of these black sounds.
Hal Jackson, he, as you mentioned, broke through the color barrier on the radio in Washington in the 1930s and became the first black host on a national broadcast network in the 50s. He died last week at the age of 96.
Yeah, what an extraordinary figure. I mean, from the 1930s all the way up until just a few weeks ago, he was on the radio and breaking barriers almost from beginning to end. He got on the radio here in Washington, initially wanted to be a sportscaster, and blacks weren't even allowed in the press box at the old Griffith Stadium where the Washington Senators played for a white crowd and the Homestead Grays played in the Negro League. And he managed to talk his way up to the roof of the stadium where the stadium announcer allowed him to try that out. And from there, he got on a Washington radio station with a talk show that turned into a music show. And this was entirely new in the late 1930s. His show was called The Bronze Review, a name that would appear around the country as well. And then he moved from Washington to New York, where he was brought by the owner of WMCA, a white UND station, where the owner said, look, I want you to do something that's going to be kind of tricky. I want you to sound just black enough that the black audience will come flocking to you, but just white enough that the whites won't know you're black. And so somehow Hal Jackson managed to do that. And for years, he was a huge name in New York radio. And it was only years later in the 1960s that his face appeared on billboards all across the city, and so people then knew for sure that he was black. Similar thing happened with Hunter Hancock out in Los Angeles, white guy who discovered black music through promoters who came to his studio and said, this is the stuff you really need to be playing rather than the jazz that he was given to. He goes on the air, becomes enormously successful, and always hides the fact that he's a white guy until 5 or 7 years into his show, he first appeared on television. And the first thing he did was lean into the camera and say, and now you know what Hunter Hancock looks like.
You know, Lewis Cantor in the show Memphis, the character Huey Calhoun, they try to lure him to New York or lure him to the North with promises of a television show and that sort of thing. And that all falls apart. But he was never really interested in that in the first place.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. They offered him, I think, some sort of network situation. He didn't want to, which meant leaving Memphis, and he wouldn't leave Memphis. Like, it was his home, and he didn't want to go basically to New York. But both Elvis and pick up on some of the underscoring, some of the things that Mark was talking about are so true with the way the switchover of food people do. He, for a long time, because he talked with that wonderful Southern accent, many people thought that that he was black. You know, he was a radio announcer. You were supposed to modulate and speak in perfect tones and da-da-da-da. And, of course, Dewey just wouldn't do it. He was a madman on the air. And the same sort of thing, actually, happened to Elvis as well. After his big hit on the Sun record, That's All Right, Little Mama, way Sam Phillips, who distributed him, he'd actually throw a big bunch of Sun records in the back of the trunk of his car, head out and start talking to the DJs, you want to play this guy. Well, he started talking to DJs about playing Elvis's record. The DJs were confused. They didn't know what was going on. Sam said Elvis was a strange bird in those days. The white announcers, of course, thought that he was black and wouldn't play him, and the black announcers thought he was white and thought he was too hillbilly sounding. So he went for a long period of time where he simply was foundering and floundering because Dewey was really promoting back home in Memphis. All the other announcers, very few of them, I think maybe one other announcer, would play Elvis Presley when he first recorded.
This was a great age for the independent record labels, right, Mark Fisher?
Yeah, I mean, this was especially for some of the small labels that recorded black artists in very local kinds of bands all across the country. This was their moment because suddenly they were getting on the radio, and it wasn't such a great time for the artists' pocket books in that there was no royalties. One of the reasons that radio stations wanted to play black records is because they didn't have to pay the same kind of royalties because they were not part of the ASCAP conglomerate that took care of royalties for artists. But it certainly got their music out there, and it got them more appearances around the country. And some DJs became very popular figures in their cities by holding these big concerts where 10, 12, 15 bands would appear over the course of a very long night. And that's where rock and roll sort of first gained its reputation as being a dangerous kind of music, because these concerts would go on. They'd draw a big crowd. Sometimes there'd be fights. Sometimes there'd be race mixing. That would always cause a big stir, whether you were in the South or the North. And this sort of cultural divide over rock and roll really has its roots in that moment when black music made the transition onto the radio.
Mark Fisher, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
Mark Fisher, author, senior editor for The Washington Post. He's written Something in the Air, Radio, Rock, and the Revolution That Shaped a Generation. Also, Lewis Cantor. Thanks so much, Lewis, for joining us.
Thank you.
Lewis Cantor, author of Dewey and Elvis, The Life and Times of a Rock and Roll DJ. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD2. 61 Columbus. Streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.